Good morning, everyone. I'm Courtney Henderson. I'm excited to be here today to present part of my dissertation work to you. I really want to thank my co-author, Jody Halpern, who unfortunately can't be here today, but who has been just an amazing inspiration and mentor to me, and without whom this project really wouldn't have occurred. So per APHA, I have no relationships to disclose. I wanted to begin by just giving some context for this particular study. This was couched within a larger study that explored the intersection of ethics, policy, and cultural influences on decision-making and adoption of non-permanent contraceptive services, specifically intrauterine devices and injectable contraceptives in northern India. The study took place in Uttar Pradesh, which is highlighted here in dark orange. It's a state in the north of India. It's a very large state with about 300 million people. And so we were working in the districts of Meerut and Bijnor. We know from sort of other international studies that have taken place that there are a lot of times when women have little opportunity to be informed about and to voluntarily choose their contraceptive services. And so it really calls into question this Western bioethics practice of informed consent and what that means in different types of contexts. Yet we know that the ideal of respecting women's autonomy, and particularly reproductive autonomy, is something that's been defended as an international goal and as a human right. In northern India, the current national population policy stipulates that both women and couples must have access to the knowledge and information upon which to make informed decisions related to contraceptive use, and that they also have to be provided with the means to actually act on that decision, so with the actual contraceptive services to be used. Yet we also know that in Uttar Pradesh, there are a lot of different constraints upon women's autonomy. Particularly related to reproductive decision-making and reproductive health services seeking. And there are really a wide range of constraints. These range from sort of the family level to those at the community to structural and gender inequalities. And all of these different types of constraints can impact a woman's ability to make decisions about a type of contraceptive that she wants to use in planning her reproductive life, and can also act as constraints in actually accessing those particular services. So that brings me to the research objectives for this particular study. We wanted to explore how women view their own decision-making power in the context of contraceptive decision-making and contraceptive seeking. And we also wanted to explore how women actually experience interactions with healthcare providers when they do go to seek these different types of services. In terms of methods, I'm not going to go into those in detail today because I really want to jump to findings, and I know we don't have a lot of time. We did conduct in-depth interviews, and I'll present the findings from interviews that we did with 42 different women in these two districts. And our data analysis was grounded theory and constant comparison as well. And if you want to talk about methods, of course, I'm happy to talk about that sort of as we get to discussion. So before I jump into some of the findings, I really wanted to give you a sense of what contraceptive delivery in the field actually looks like in this context. So here you can see a healthcare worker who's providing different types of contraceptives. We have sort of condoms in the front, packaging for intrauterine devices, and there's a whole row of women who are lined up, who have come to get a contraceptive today. In this building, it's sort of a small one-room building. There's this long hall going towards the back to another room, sort of an exam room, and there are women sort of lined up all the way down the hallway, sort of seated on the ground. Their children are in tow. You can see we have children sort of peering in the window, trying to find out what's going on. It's really chaotic. There were dogs sort of running in and out of the building. The door is wide open all the time. So it's just sort of this very frenetic activity. There is not a lot of privacy here, as you can tell, and the interactions between a woman and the healthcare provider tend to be very, very quick. And we can talk about how that impacts a woman's ability to receive counseling and things like that related to contraceptives. So jumping right into the findings, we finished in-depth interviews with 42 different women. The majority of women were in their late 20s to early 30s, though we certainly had a range in age. Almost about half of our respondents had 0 to 5 years of education, so not a really educated population that we were talking to, and all but two of our respondents were housewives. That was their primary responsibility, to stay home, to raise the kids, to do the cooking, cleaning, etc. Most of our respondents did live in joint households. In this region, it's customary for women to get married at a fairly young age and then to go and live with her husband and the husband's family. We talked to both Hindu and Muslim women, and the split was about two-thirds Hindu and a third Muslim. And about half of the population that we talked to reported that their monthly household income for the whole household unit was less than 5,000 rupees. And at today's exchange rate, that's about $82 a month. And here you can just see age at marriage and age at first birth. Again, they're fairly young. So in this context, women tend to get married quite young, and then there's impetus to prove your fertility and to bear children quite young, and to sort of, you know, bear several children fairly closely spaced together. So we were particularly interested in exploring women's interactions with their healthcare providers and what consent processes looked like related to that. But we found that a lot of women really wanted to talk about what was happening at home for them before they were actually even able to go to a provider. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit first. We found that women had to gain their husband's approval prior to seeking contraceptives, and we've seen that in a lot of other studies that are based in India. And I love this quote. This is from a 23-year-old injectable user who says that if my husband wants me to use birth control, then I'll use it. And if he doesn't want me to use it, then I won't use it. So there was a lot of talk that occurred among the women that we interviewed about sort of not really conversations that occurred between husband and wife, but just this is what he says and this is what I have to do. And then women also discussed how even if they were interested in a particular type of contraceptive or had learned of a certain contraceptive, for example, injectables, and said, I want to use this, or I want to use IUDs, the husband could really, he could override the wife, essentially. And so here we have a respondent who's saying, I was thinking of using the multi-load, or multi-load in Hindi, which is what women talk about here. It's how they refer to an IUD. So we have a woman who was really interested in using an IUD. She really wanted to space her children. She didn't want to have another child for a long time. And a lot of the women that we talked to had very specific reasons for why they wanted to wait, why they wanted to be able to control their reproduction. And those ranged from things like, I need time to recover from having my last child, I need to be able to work, I need to be able to cook for my whole family, and I need time for my body to rest. So women had very sort of clear ideas about why they wanted to wait and why they wanted to be able to control their reproduction. But again, when we come to the specific type of contraceptive that a woman wants to use, it's really up to her husband. And so this particular woman says that my husband says I have to get the injection. All of these injectables are Depo-Provera, which is a once every 3 month shot. So he says I have to use it for a year or two and then we'll see what happens. And we'll decide in the future. So similarly, at the household level, we found the mother-in-law to be a primary influencer of a woman's use of contraceptives. So first, women also had to gain the mother-in-law's approval. Typically, she had to go to her husband first. Once he okays it, then she goes to her mother-in-law, and she has to okay it as well. And what was interesting here is that women talked a lot about the different types of risks to their safety and well-being if they didn't follow their mother-in-law. They didn't really talk about that related to their husbands, but they did talk about that a lot related to their mothers-in-law. And so here is, you know, another woman, fairly young, she's 20 years old, she's currently using injectable contraceptives, and she says, if I do things on my own, if I go and get my injection on my own, and without talking to my mother first, then it'll be harmful to me. And there were sort of a lot of these connotations that came across of, you know, potential harms, and I could get hurt. And women didn't tend to go into specifics about that, but were clearly worried that, you know, their well-being, their welfare could be impacted if they didn't get permission. And that was permission not just to use a particular type of contraceptive, it's also permission to leave the home, to actually go to a healthcare service delivery point to get a contraceptive, and really permission to do a lot of other types of things as well, sort of outside of reproductive health and contraceptive decision making. So now if we turn toward looking at women's experiences with healthcare providers, we found that when women actually went to a service delivery center, they were usually informed of only one contraceptive. So, thank you. So, you know, there are injectables available, or you should get an IUD. They weren't informed of sort of the range of methods that could be made available to them. And they weren't informed of potential side effects for the methods, and we can imagine how this would really impact a woman's decision to use a certain type of contraceptive. We also found that providers tended to discuss these services with the husbands. So a lot of women would say things like this. So the provider didn't say anything. After the getting the injection, I just came out, and my husband might know. And a lot of women talked about this, you know, my husband might know, or I don't know when I'm going for the next injection, you have to ask my husband. And when we sort of tried to delve into specifics around, you know, did your husband tell you anything about what the provider said, it was just, no, it's, you really have to talk to my husband, he knows about it, the doctor talked to him, they didn't talk to me, I just went and got the injection, that was it. We also found a promotion of longer-term methods among healthcare providers. This was particularly among ASHAs, or accredited social health activists. They're women who work at the village level. They've typically lived in the village for a very, very long time. They're very well known in the community. And they basically go door to door trying to get women to adopt different types of contraceptive services. And they do a lot of other things as well. They get children vaccinated and try to get women to institutions for birth instead of home birth, things like that. But women talked about how the ASHAs were really trying to get them to use IUDs, even if they wanted to use injectables, or to get them to undergo female sterilization as opposed to some of the shorter-term methods. And I think it's really important in thinking about women's reproductive autonomy in this context that we recognize that in these particular sites, the ASHAs are actually paid according to what type of contraceptive method they get a woman to adopt. So here, ASHAs are paid about 50 rupees to get a woman to adopt an injectable, 100 rupees for an IUD, and 200 rupees to get a woman into a clinic for female sterilization. So obviously, that type of influence or constraint can really impact a woman's autonomy here. So I just want to wrap up because we only have a couple of more minutes. I think that there are a lot of different types of programmatic and research ethics implications to this work. So programmatically, clearly women are not prepared with the information and knowledge that they need to actually make decisions about what type of contraceptive they actually want to use. Women do have a very, very clear idea about when they want to have children, about when they want to delay or postpone childbearing. And so I think it's important that we think about ways to empower women so that their voices can actually be heard, so they can say, you know, I do want to delay, and they can then have the conversations with their husbands or with their mothers-in-law or the other stakeholders that are involved in this really important decision for women's lives. One sort of very tangible way of doing that would be something like women's support groups. A lot of women told us that they didn't have the opportunity to talk to other women or learn from other women in their community. Part of that's because they're often not allowed to leave the house unless their husband says so. So thinking about ways of sort of building the scaffolding to empower women with the knowledge and information that they need in seeking contraceptives. In terms of research ethics and public health ethics in general, thank you, I think that there are implications related to sort of how we tend to import these Western notions of control and individual autonomy. And in this context, familial autonomy is clearly very important and maybe much more realistic for the women who are living in these contexts. So I'd like to challenge us to think about how do we engage these other stakeholders, how do we develop consent processes related to both seeking healthcare services and then also for research when we actually go in and want to conduct research like that. And so I'll just end with that. I'm looking forward to discussion. And I did want to thank my collaborators, Anne Berg-Villemson, who is an amazing help in the field in terms of data collection. The NGO that I worked closely with, World Health Partners, in New Delhi and Uttar Pradesh. And then UC Berkeley for their financial support, and most importantly, all of the women who were very generous in sharing their time and experiences. So thank you very much.